Hello and welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. In today's episode, I speak to Emmy Faust about her journey as an angel investor, why female founders are still getting less than 2% of venture funding, why she decided not to raise a VC fund, and why it's massively important to think about wellness and mental health as a founder, but especially as a female founder. Really excited for this one. Let's get to it. It is great to have you here with us in the studio today, Emmy.
Thank you. I'm kind of impressed you managed to get it all in a very short sentence. Everything I'm doing, so thank you.
No, not a problem at all. I feel like there is a huge amount to unpack there. So let's get straight to it. You know, we've all seen the statistics, less than 2% of funding goes to female founders. And that number has actually decreased, I think, over the last 12 months as we've entered this really sort of stale period in the whole kind of investment environment. From your perspective, why is that and what needs to change? And I appreciate that's a big question to be asking, but I'd love to get your perspective on that.
Okay, so let's go with why and then what needs to change. That is something that I have really been struggling to understand. I think when I was doing my consultancy, I was sort of like in a little bubble. Sometimes I was helping early stage businesses, some more further down the line, and I wasn't really necessarily so aware of this issue. But as I became more and more interested in supporting women, and obviously like I sort of heard about this in the background, and I was like, I'm going to commit all my investment funds to women, because I knew that there was an issue, but I hadn't like dug deep into it. And I kept seeing all these stats and it really concerned me. And I could see that it was concerning a lot of other people, men and women, that we kept seeing these like big headlines, like, you know, less than 2% of VC funding, 1% of, and it's just like, that just feels shit. You know, that feels horrible as a woman. And actually I think, you know, for most men, they're like, we can't. So I took it upon myself to just really try and understand. I was like, there's got to be a reason and I'm going to sort it out. And I was very naive to think that, because I literally just thought, if I work hard enough, I can find out what the solution is and I'm going to sort it out. So I started speaking to loads of people. And as part of Female Founders Rise, that was one of the things I said that we're going to do. We're going to get more female founders funded. And I still want to do that. And so basically what I did, started speaking to VCs, spoke to the British Business Bank, spoke to the lady from the Rose Review. I actually pulled together this whole amazing collection of people for our first advisory board for Female Founders Rise. And I was like, I really want to understand what's going on. People that have written books. And there seemed to be lots of different reasons. And it depends who you speak to. And this is what I also find challenging, is that like everyone gives you a different answer. And some people say, oh, I don't think it is that, actually. I think it's another reason. But there's obviously unconscious and conscious bias against women. Another thought is that we're just talking about VC, 1% of VC or 2% of VC. And actually, there's way less women there's way less pitches being seen from women. And the general thought from a lot of people is that maybe less women have VC-backable businesses. I mean, a VC-backable business is, it's intense. You're basically going to be giving your whole life over. I remember getting a small investment in the past and just actually deciding I did want a lifestyle business. I didn't want to scale this business, and I gave the money back. And so, you know, is it right that less women have VC-backable businesses? Maybe that's their decision. Another thought is that, and there's research to sort of show all these things, and I've read the research, but I can't, you know, remember where it is. We could probably track it all down. But that women are more likely to run sort of purpose-led businesses. And interestingly, we were talking about this yesterday. We had a Female Founders Rise networking event, and so many women there were setting up a business that was answering a problem that they had, and they really were purpose-led, and therefore maybe they're less VC-backable. There's also the research that shows that women are more likely to be asked questions that, I can't remember what the word is, but basically questions that challenge them in a different way to the questions that are asked men. Do you know what the word that I'm looking for?
I don't know the word, but I know what you're talking about. So effectively, as an example, investors will ask, an investor will ask a man, okay, how are we going to get to, you know, venture scale?
Exactly.
However, they'll ask a woman, is this really venture scalable, as an example?
Exactly. So there's a piece of research and there's an actually, and I can't think of the exact word. We'll find it and we can share it in future. So there's that. And I think that then the other thing is men have got better networks to access people that can open doors, that have got power, that have got funding, and women just don't have that kind of access. And so therefore, because it's so important to have a warm lead in order to get those introductions to VCs and investors, if you don't have that network, then obviously you're not at that advantage. And I think it's something like 13 times more likely to be successful with a warm lead. So there's all these things that just stacked against women. I think there's also a big part from what I've noticed from speaking to all our female founders, Rise founders, is just having like confidence in, you know, when they're going to pitch these men. And, you know, some of them just say, I just wish I, you know, was able to talk like a man. Because I think the other thing, and quite a lot of female founders, including those who've had funding, have said this, is that we will be much more realistic and conservative with our figures, whereas men will just say, oh yeah, I'm going to make, you know, however much. And I'm like that as well. You know, we don't want to sort of lie or exaggerate.
I found this a lot working with a number of female founders over time. Exactly as you say, there's a bias towards conservatism in the numbers. There isn't that sort of overly exaggerated up and to the right kind of like we're gonna be able to get to 100 billion within the next 2 years. There is also a fair amount of, I would say, like imposter syndrome, self-awareness of gaps, and a lot of the female founders I've worked with are much more cautious about not only what they say but how they build and how much they, you know, how much they will necessarily do the kind of venture style building of, yeah, we're just going to throw everything at everything and see what happens. They have much more of a plan. I think they often, when they're getting into conversations, especially with VC investors, find themselves get a little bit unstuck because they get questioned on why they haven't moved as quickly as say another business has.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I've also been trying to speak to VCs as part of this. And whilst it's very difficult to get VCs to comment publicly on LinkedIn, I found, they're all happy to have conversations with me. And some of them just say, like, we don't see enough decks from female founders. So that they're getting this deluge of decks coming in to their email or whatever. And there's just a very small amount of female founders coming in, but they're not actually doing that work to actively go out and find them. And, you know, that's one of the things I'm trying to do with Female Founders Rise, to say, look, we've got all these amazing women, come and meet them. But that's not to say that all these amazing women want VC backing or are VC backable. So I think the other part of it is, which we're trying to do with Female Founders Rise, is to really educate our community around what is VC, what's venture capital, what's it mean for you, what's a VC backable business, what's angel investing, you know, what are the different funding options and actually which one's right for you. Because personally, I would never take VC funding. I just wouldn't want that pressure. I also wonder, there was a really interesting article in the Times today. I don't even know who the guy was. I think he was someone probably famous, but I didn't know him, who was saying we should stop pushing for unicorns because it's almost like, you know, with this focus on unicorns, we sometimes are pushing businesses too far and it's just almost like scale or die.
Yeah, 100%.
I don't like that. I much prefer a profitable, sustainable business. And so I wouldn't, you know, for me, I wouldn't want a VC-backed business.
That kind of thought process you just had, and you know, you talked about giving money back and bootstrapping. I think one of the things is language, right? So we talk about lifestyle businesses. Well, actually, you know, lifestyle businesses aren't lifestyle businesses often. They are highly profitable, sustainable, life-changing businesses. It's just that they aren't, as you say, you know, those unicorn-esque businesses. And of course, even today, the unicorns, you know, are proving themselves to be wearing no clothes, right? We've all seen it in the public markets where all these really, really highly valued businesses have come crashing down. There's a couple of articles we've just pulled up. So I think the article from the Times today is from by the UK startup Tsar Jeremy Silver, who said stop hunting unicorns. And there was some research done in 2017 at a TechCrunch conference, which showed that men are asked more promotional questions, i.e. how are we going to do this?
And
women are asked more preventative questions. Why won't it? Why is this not going to happen? As opposed to why will it happen? Which I think also goes to that whole point around language and how we perceive things. I think that can be, you know, highly sort of challenging for someone, even whether it's a male or a female. If you're told you're not going to do this or it's going to be difficult to achieve this, it's much more likely that you won't then go out and try and achieve it, as opposed to, okay, how can we help you, or how do we think this is going to happen, which is a very, very different framing. So, you know, there's obviously a huge amount that needs to change there. And one of the things that probably needs to change is the diversity within venture, the diversity within the ecosystem altogether. You know, is this a systemic problem? Is this something that, you know, it can be resolved through education, through more sort of awareness? And actually, I think that's a really interesting point that I'd love to explore is, you know, you went down the path of actually thinking about setting up a VC fund, and presumably to try and change some of these biases and issues that we've just been talking about. So, you know, we've talked to a lot of emerging managers on this podcast, and obviously they've all raised a fund or have tried to raise a fund and have, you know, raised a smaller fund maybe than they initially anticipated. But let's talk about your journey about through not raising a fund. What were the learnings, and what were the issues that ultimately led you to decide, you know what, this isn't for me, and actually I'd much rather do what I'm doing as an angel investor with and with Female Founders Rise. It'd be amazing to understand that story.
So this is, again, me being naive and just thinking I can change the world, and thinking I've been successful, I know what I'm doing, I've set up and scaled and sold businesses. And I believe that a big part of success is understanding marketing and your numbers. And that's what I'm really good at, and that's what I've done. And I see a lot of VCs chucking money at businesses, and then they come to me and they literally don't have a clue what they're doing. So I was like, well, if I set up a VC fund, I could get the money to the right people, and I could also almost like mentor them in a sort of incubator style, so that they don't waste that money. And so from an investor's perspective, I was like, that's basically a no-brainer, you know. And in my head, rather than this like unicorn ideas, like I only want one to bring me 100 times, I wanted all 10 to bring me 10 times. I wanted everyone to be successful, and I wanted everyone to make their success in my little pod. Okay, this is the dream world. So I was like, well, why can't I do it? I mean, I've got LinkedIn, I've got a big audience on LinkedIn. I've got female founders that I know from Female Founders Rise. So lots of people told me about this thing called VC Lab, which is like an accelerator to become a VC. So I told everyone I was going to do it. I was really excited. I nearly didn't apply. I think I'd been ill or something. And then Alex took the kids out, and I thought, oh God, I better apply for that. I literally like got out of bed, greasy hair, dark. I mean, and I just put record on. I didn't even prep anything. And I just said, this is why I should have a fund, and this is what my thesis would be. I literally just learned what the thesis was by looking on their website, and I sent it off thinking nothing will happen, because there wasn't even any. It was like literally I did it in the dark. Anyway, they came back and they said, you're perfect, we want you on board. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. I mean, maybe they say to everyone they're perfect. And so I went down this route of thinking I was going to do it. It became very clear very quickly that it wasn't going to work. And that is because if you haven't worked in venture capital, you will struggle to set up a fund. That's what I believe. And so, unfortunately, lots of women and people from underrepresented backgrounds haven't worked in venture capital. So it's going to be very difficult for them to set up a VC fund. The other thing is, unless you've had angel investments on your particular thesis that have succeeded, then again, you haven't really got any proof. So it is irrelevant that I'd done really well, that I'd succeeded, that I'd exited, that I'd had successful exits and I'd grown a, you know, marketing agency. No one would care about that. And my angel investments, I only started in the summer last year. So clearly none of them, nothing's happened to any of them. So I didn't have any proof. Now I had read this brilliant book called It's About Damn Time. Have you read that by Arlen Hamilton?
I haven't. No.
Oh my gosh, it's brilliant. So Arlen Hamilton is a black gay woman who was homeless for ages. And she basically, I mean, it's the most incredible story, ended up setting up a fund that invests in underrepresented founders. And I'd read this book ages ago and I thought it was brilliant. And I read it again and I was like, well, if she can do it, and you know, she hasn't got, I wasn't homeless. I've had an education and I was like, what she's done is incredible. And it was so inspiring. So I was like, I'm going to do it and try and do the same as her. In the book, she explains how difficult it is, and I don't think I'd realize how difficult it would be. So it just became very clear early on that I just wasn't, and also in this environment, in economic climate, I wasn't going to raise a fund. Also, the other thing was I suddenly realized this, like, I'm committing myself to 10 years because it's going to be 10 years.
And
I
was like,
I was like, on my own, no thanks. Massive, actually, it's quite a big stress because everyone will be expecting a return and they'll probably be badgering me all the time. And, you know, we were talking about this a bit before, but I had a bit of a breakdown last year and I had long COVID. So, you know, I'm really trying to manage my stress. So definitely don't want that stress. Don't want to commit to anything for 10 years because I don't know where I'm going to be in 10 years. I don't know if I'm going to want to be working. I'm sure I will, but I might be doing something totally different. I've got my family to think about, got 4 kids. And also the other thing was, it's like, I want to be empowering women and saying yes and championing them and saying, you're doing amazing work. And if I was to have a VC fund, I'd literally be saying no to everyone, apart from like a few people. So I decided that rather than saying no to everyone, I wanted to say yes to everyone. And the way that I could say yes to everyone is through Female Founders Rise, through championing them, through connecting them, maybe with the right angels or the right VCs or the right funding. And yeah, it was just a massive relief, basically, to say. But what I hadn't realized is because I'd also announced it on LinkedIn, there was all these people in the background that were like, oh, Emmy's setting up a fund. And they kept asking me about it. And I was like, oh, my God, I didn't realize that, like, everyone's watching me. So then I had to do this announcement on LinkedIn that I'm not going to do it. But anyway, that was fine.
That announcement was probably the most, I think, human, humble post that I've read. And what I was thinking just as you were saying all of this was, I think sometimes it feels like we need permission to be able to say, I'm not doing this. And I think, you know, I think it is hugely empowering for someone who has been successful as you have been to say, you know what, I can't do this. I don't want to do this. It isn't right for me. Because that may also help other people who are really struggling through that decision to say, well, actually, you know what? It's okay for me not to pursue this because there are other things that I could be doing that are just as equally empowering and that I'm better at or that I'm more passionate about. And I think that's super, super, you know, valuable for people to understand. And I'm really touched and happy that you are able to say that, you know, with very, you know, clear clarity, and that you've said it here on this podcast. In fact, just whilst you were talking, the other couple of things that went through my mind was, you know, we've had a couple of VCs that have been through VC Lab here on this podcast, but we also recently interviewed Eleanor Kay, who is the managing director of the Newton Venture Program, which also does try and target underrepresented, not founders, but GPs, people who want to raise a fund. And I think, you know, there is a lot of stuff happening, whether it's diversity VC included or the Newton Venture Program for that matter, that are trying to tackle these systemic problems with underrepresented, again, not founders, but GPs and emerging managers, so that they have that access to the ecosystem, they have that access to people, to LPs potentially, but also that they can learn from the people that have gone through it and done it, and understand what the challenges were. And I think that is massively, as I say, empowering and valuable for people to hear. And again, I think, you know, you said it yourself, you wanted to focus on what you're passionate about. So let's talk about Female Founders
Rise. Can I just quickly say one really quick thing?
Yeah, please.
The other thing was, is I've got a very engaged audience on LinkedIn and my background is in marketing. So I was like, okay, fine. I'll be able to do it through marketing. But one of the big reasons for it, that it was a no-no for me was that the minute I got in, they were like, you can't tell anyone that you're doing this. You can't tell anyone about your thesis. You can't tell anyone. No one must know. You can't post anything on LinkedIn. And I was like, if I can't tell anyone about this amazing thing that I'm trying to do, or I'm trying to get more female founders funded, you know, that's my superpower. So if I can't use my superpower, like, what am I doing? It just didn't make any sense, because in my head, I would use the power of LinkedIn and marketing to get more investors who would give me the money to put into the female founders. So that was a big thing for me, actually, the fact that it was all sort of have to be done in secret, that I didn't.
And presumably that's to not run foul of the FCA or whatever.
Exactly. And I hadn't realized that. And there's another thing as well, incredibly expensive. I hadn't realized there's all these rules, like, about what you're allowed to do, and the expense to set up a venture capital fund. I mean, it was ridiculous. So yeah. Anyway, moved on quite quickly from that.
Yeah.
And then what was the next question?
Well, no. So I was going to say, so there's a couple of other things that came out. So you said, you know, you didn't want to say no. In fact, one of the things I've seen often on Twitter and LinkedIn is I've seen, whether it's female founders, whether it's underrepresented founders, you know, they approach a fund with a female focus and don't get funded. And then they sort of, you know, they almost have this visceral reaction that, well, you say you fund female founders, but you don't, because you didn't fund me. And the problem there is that actually, again, if you're raising VC, the whole point is you want power law returns, which means you can't invest in all female founders. You have to invest in the venture, you know, the venture schedule, the ones that are going to become those outliers. And to have a platform model where, or you know, a model where you invest in, you know, a whole swathe of startups that are likely to give you a 5x or a 6x return over time, you know, maybe $100 million exit rather than $1 billion exit, you know, that does exist. There are, you know, people like Founders Factory effectively do that, where they, you know, they have that optionality, or they create that option, future option, by investing in, you know, 600,000, 700,000 businesses, as they have done. Not all of those businesses will become venture scalable, and in fact, you know, I think there aren't that many out of Founders Factory that have become venture scale, but there are lots of great businesses that will do well and will exit and provide a return. So I think there is definitely, you know, I think that is definitely something that people are starting to explore and understand a bit more, especially as the whole kind of, as you said earlier, that whole myth around the unicorn sort of status has started deflating, and actually, you know, if everyone is a unicorn, is anything a unicorn, is kind of the way I think about it. But yeah, so coming on to female founders rise, I'd love to understand, you know, how does it empower female founders, and why should a female founder join your community? What are the, and what are the challenges building that community? Because, you know, I've seen quite a few of these over the last several years. There's a lot of people trying to tackle this kind of issue around systemic underrepresentation or under inclusion. It would be great, to understand what are the challenges in building the community, and why they should join the community, and what you can offer them, I guess.
Okay, so why they should join, or why they do join, and I've asked them this, I've just done a piece of research and we've had about 120 people so far respond. I think one of the reasons they join is that it's independent, that it's set up by a female founder. So I totally get it. I'm an exited founder. I totally understand where they're at. I think there's also, people say that the reasons that they say they join or that they love it is the quality of the resources is amazing. So obviously in 20 years that I've been doing this, I've got a like amazing, you know, book or Rolodex of the best people. So like you said, you might come and do something. So basically, essentially, I've got all these incredible people running masterclasses, running office hours, running Q&As, and often I'm there as well. So they're getting access to really top quality advice. We do online networking and we do offline networking. So that offline networking, we had one yesterday. So they sell out in 2 days, and we had 75 people come yesterday. We had some friendly angels and VCs, and female founders that were much further on, and they're there to sort of give advice, open doors. You know how we talked earlier about how getting warm introductions and opening doors and understanding how VC works and all those things are so important. So that's the purpose, but also to bring these women together, because for collaboration, for fun, for support, to understand and learn from each other in a safe space. So that's why people are joining. They say they're joining because of the community, because of the support of other people for the networking and for the masterclasses and all the insights and resources. And also every week we send out an email which has details on all the stuff that's coming up, and also like 6 resources every week that help female founders. So that is why they should join. What they get is access to a community with, as I said, online and offline networking, lots of masterclasses around marketing, growth, funding, raising, pitch deck reviews, and then just being part of a community that's championing female founders. So like, that's just what we do. And what are the challenges of building the community? I would say I'm trying to do it in a very lean way. I almost like want to show female founders like how to get traction and how to do this. So like, I haven't spent any money on the branding. The website was 200 quid and at the moment it looks shit, but it's a work in progress. I basically set it up using a LinkedIn page, which is totally free, created a little banner and a Google form, which asks people what stage they're at, where they're based, and what sort of resources and help they wanted. And then also part of the form is if you're an investor or a supporter or an angel, you can also say how you'd like to get involved. So we've had 1,300 people or something fill in that form. That all started on LinkedIn, sorry. And then from that, we've created a database and segmented people so that they get the right emails. I think it's really time consuming. I put a huge amount of love into it. I really genuinely care. At the moment, I don't know how I'm going to scale it. I don't know how I'm going to monetize it. That's a big, you know, not worry, but everyone's like, you know, how are you going to monetize this thing? And like, for me, I don't need to know that because yeah. I'm an exited founder and I've got money. I don't need to pay myself right now. So I'm in a position, obviously a very lucky position, where I can just run something because I love it. And I put a bit of money into the bank account so it can tick over. I believe that if you have a business that has a need and is answering problems and is providing solutions, then money will come. Yeah. You know, I'm not worried about that now. But I think that is the challenge, is that I'm not chucking loads of money at it. Because obviously if I was chucking loads of money at it, I'd have amazing branding. I'd have people running conferences for me. And it's probably, you know, it's tiring. So yesterday I literally gave 70 people a hug, hello. And I tried to make sure that everyone was networking and that everyone was meeting people. And I was introducing the right female founders, the right investors. And afterwards I was like absolutely exhausted. But I love it. So I'd say that's the biggest, you know, and I'd say to someone, so someone said to me, how long is it taking to grow female founders wise? And I said like, you know, 4 months or whatever it was to 1,000 people. And they'd be like, oh, wow, I might do that. But what I didn't say is like, it's taken me 20 years of building relationships on LinkedIn with all the experts, for everyone to know me, like me and trust me to say, go and join. It's a really good offering. So basically, it's taken me 20 years.
Look, I love that. The reality is that I think, you know, personal brand is what pushes everything, especially at startups, at startup level, right? Like your product can do so much, but often it is about you, the founder, etc. I love the fact that you are doing by showing. So you're showing, you know, in a really, really scrappy, lean way. Okay, yes, you have the comfort, as you said, but you're still doing it in a lean way. And I think that's an important lesson, you know, for people to understand and learn. And often, you know, the problem is we all think, oh, we need to raise money in order to be able to do something. Well, actually, you can start off with a LinkedIn page, with a Google form, with, you know, a crappy website that you can just get wait lists, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, you know, often build on Google, build on, you know, Excel first and then automate later. You know, I think a lot of people, certainly over the last 10 years, have become so enamored or so sort of, you know, starstruck by this kind of funding environment that we've had, that they've assumed that the only way to get going is to raise funding. I've probably made that mistake myself with one of my businesses and in retrospect sort of sat there and thought, well, actually, maybe I should have just bootstrapped this and I'd be in a very different place today than I actually am. I actually think that, you know, it's incredibly obviously impressive that you've built, you know, a community of 1,000 people in such a short time. And, you know, I think, again, it shows the value of the network that you've built over the last 20 years. And it's the one piece of advice I give to all founders, to students when they're coming out of university or, you know, asking for advice, is build a network, build relationships today, not because you want something, not because they're transactional, not because you're looking for money today, investment today, or you're looking for support today, but because if you build that relationship over the next 3, 5, 10 years, at some point, you may be able to leverage that relationship in a positive way, not that it's transactional, but in a positive way. And I think, you know, people today are too sort of caught up in the fact that they want everything to happen immediately in the next 24 hours or the next 1 week, when actually, as you say, it takes time and energy to build the trust, the relationships, and the knowledge ultimately, because, you know, 20 years of operating, of you know, building three businesses, exiting them, has taught you a huge amount, which you cannot learn by reading a book. You have to do it. You cannot learn by listening to this podcast. You have to do it. But, you know, hopefully what it tells people is that, yes, you can do it, but it's going to take time. It's going to take effort. And I think, you know, one of the things I wrote about recently was that people seem less interested in doing the hard things. But to get great things, you have to do the hard things first, and you can't get to great without doing that. So, no, mm-hmm. I think that's amazing. And look, for all our listeners, where's the best place for them to come and try and apply to Females Founders?
LinkedIn. So LinkedIn, on the LinkedIn page, they can apply on the site as well, which is femalefoundersrise.com. But I mean, you just said so many interesting things there. I think it is really important. I mean, I often talk to people and they say, I don't know if I should raise funding or whatever. And I'm like, what's your business? And they'll say something like an agency or something, what we like, but that's not a sort of scalable business that investors want to fund. So I really do believe that people are getting sidetracked. So many people say, stop getting distracted by thinking you want funding and going down this funding route, when actually what you need to do is just get traction. You haven't got any customers, you haven't got anyone paying you, you don't even know if you've got a product or service that people want. So spend that time trying to do that. And what I just say is, like, even, yes, I've got the luxury of time, but for example, with the networking, the offline networking, I charge straight away. So that will cover the cost of the venue and makes a small amount of money just to pay the BA. And for our International Women's Day, I thought, I want to get sponsors, but it was hard to get people to pay £3,000. So I just said, I need 6 people to sponsor me £500. And like, it took me a day. Mm. And 6 people on LinkedIn came back instead of doing it. So that, I think, you know, it's just about thinking. And I've tried to explain this sometimes to clients. It's just about starting small. And I'm just trying to cover my costs at the moment, and to get to the point that I can show that this is needed, which I think I have, because, you know, I'm getting inundated by every day. I have, like, organically, like, 10 to 15 people will join, which is amazing. But yeah, I totally agree with you. I think we make out that VC funding or funding is this great big thing which we should celebrate. We should definitely celebrate people who get funding because it's bloody hard work, but we don't celebrate all the bootstrappers who are nailing it. I mean, I bootstrapped all my businesses and, you know, it was very successful, probably more successful than a lot of people who took VC funding and failed.
It's super interesting. I have 2 businesses, one that's bootstrapped, one that I've taken external funding from. And amazingly, the bootstrap business is skyrocketing whilst the one that I got funded is unfortunately not. And I think, you know, I think there's a mentality that comes with bootstrapping because it is your money. You are having to, you know, you are having to earn the money that you're spending before you spend it. So you are much, much more cautious and considerate about where that money goes and where you utilize it. And ultimately, also, when you raise funding externally, it puts constraints on you and it also puts obligations on you. And I think that's one thing that it cannot be said enough, that once you raise funding, so this someone told me this once, once you raise funding, you have guaranteed an exit to your investors. What that exit looks like is debatable. It could be nothing. It could be EIS write-off. It could be, you know, a massive exit, but you are guaranteeing an exit because that is why they've invested. Whereas if you're bootstrapping, you can decide, you know, do you want to exit? Do you want to continue running the business? Whatever it is. I think there's a lot to be unpacked in general around, you know, the value of taking funding, not taking funding, which businesses should and shouldn't. It's something that I talk about all the time. You know, there are lots of sources of capital out there, but equally, you know, the best capital is revenue. The best funding is revenue at the end of the day. If you've got customers that are paying for you, that shows that you've got value, that there is a product or a service that you're providing that people want to pay for. And, you know, if you can do that, then you're halfway there already. One of the things I want to just sort of wrap up, this has been an incredible conversation, but, you know, you talked a little bit earlier about your own sort of health issues last year. You know, the podcast is called Nothing Ventured. It's all about sort of taking a punt. But I appreciate that often, especially for underrepresented and female founders, it's very difficult to do that because there is a whole balance that needs to be struck. How do you think about well-being and mental health? And how do you communicate to, you know, those female founders that are in your community the importance of that and how they can manage, you know, between, you know, whether it's building the business, whether it's managing their family, whether it is, you know, whatever else they may be doing. And let's face it, it is predominantly women that are, you know, we could say, well, okay, you know, there are men that, you know, that look after the kids as well, but it is far, far fewer men that look after their kids than it is women. It is far fewer men that, you know, make the dinner, you know, look at the house,
do
deal
the
with
home.
The schools.
It's all the logistics,
stuff.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
it's the
absolutely.
Mental load that as a woman you have. And interestingly, I noticed this. It's like the mums will always ask me concerns. They come to, can Axel come to the birthday party? And or the schools phone me or email me about, and I said to Alex, do you get those emails? And he's like, he gets the generic ones because I made sure he's on the list, but the one-off ones and, you know, all the WhatsApp groups and then, you know, caring for your parents, often as the woman, you know, you're deemed to be the one that's better to care for them. So there's this huge mental load. I think a lot of, I think a reason a lot of businesses fail, businesses in general, we're not talking about female founders or male founders, is from burnout. And it is just so full on being a founder. It's like your expectations, the loneliness. So if you think that that's a big factor, which I believe it probably is in businesses failing alongside everything else, I think for women, we've got that extra, you know, mental load, and it's so much to try and the juggle. And I've just seen it myself. You know, I kind of was fine when I was running my business initially. Maybe that's because I had a co-founder and I was younger and, you know, I hadn't been through the pandemic. I kind of would just sail through and I see my friends and I do my exercise and I was nailing it at work and everything was great. You know, not everything, but like it was all felt fine. But I think without your well-being is critical to success, because if you don't have well-being, if you're in pain physically, you know, it's a real struggle to work. And mentally, if you're struggling mentally, I mean, it's like it's pretty much a write-off, especially to take on all the stress around funding and running a business. And personally, I just had a really, really terrible time post-COVID during the pandemic with four kids. My husband lost his job, which was a really massive impact for him and me. And COVID just did a lot of things to my mental and physical well-being that meant I was in a total state for pretty much a year and a half. Even though I had times when I felt better and I thought I was getting better, but then I'd have these massive like low points where I felt awful and sensory overload and just couldn't function like I normally do. So that for me is such a wake-up call. And I really worry about the well-being of founders, but I'm particularly focused on female founders, so I'm particularly worried about that. And just we put so much stress on ourselves to be successful and to like run successful businesses and to achieve and to get funding and, you know, all these things that we desperately want to do because we're so inspired and we're ambitious and we're driven. But like at the same time, we're also trying to be a good mom and go to all the things and getting dressed up for the whatever day it is and remember to do that. You know, there's just so much going on and it's overwhelming. And like, I just fell apart and I just think that, and you know, I have help as well. So I just think it is really difficult. And how do we manage that? I think we have to talk about it more. Interestingly, I sort of mentioned this to you before, but when we do our online networking and we're talking about our challenges and you'd think people would be like, fundraising is my biggest challenge, or this is, you know, marketing or whatever. A lot of the challenges are around our mental health, setting boundaries. How do we juggle it all? How do we be a good mum? What if we want to have children? You know, there was one you know, some of the conversations around people really wanting to have children, but feeling like they couldn't because they'd taken funding. So yeah, I don't know how we sort that, but for me, it's just, I don't know, like it is telling people to look after their mental wellbeing and physical wellbeing. I don't know if that's enough. I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answer to that, but it is something that I'm really passionate about and I want to help more people with.
I think there are a couple of things there. I mean, like from my own experience, I can categorically say I would not have been able to do what I've done over the last 7 years if my wife had not been effectively managing everything in the household, from the kids to the house itself or the flat itself, to, you know, to just making sure that everything was as needed to be, right? Because ultimately, you know, it is a really, really difficult job just to be doing that on its own. And I think adding on the pressure of building a business is obviously a massive thing. The things that have really helped, I think, you know, over time for me, is understanding that coaching, therapy, these are all really, really important things. And as you know, I started therapy, you know, maybe May last year, I think. It has been, bar nothing, the most transformational thing that's happened to me in my life. It has allowed me to understand not just more about myself, but also my approach to business and why I've tried to do certain things in the way that I've tried to do them. And I think if you understand those things, you're much better equipped to then cope with them when things aren't going really well. So, you know, I just talked about one of my businesses not necessarily going in the right direction. I'm relatively sanguine about that. I mean, I'm disappointed that it has, that it hasn't, but I know now enough after, again, similar to you, 20 years to detach my ego from the business and to segregate and compartmentalize those sort of two things. And I think, you know, it is very difficult, whatever race, gender, et cetera, you are. But I think for female founders, where there is that additional pressure of, you know, and it may not be that they have emotional or mental health issues going on at the moment, but as you just said, you know, it might be someone in the family. You know, you mentioned your husband or your partner lost his job. You know, maybe one of the kids is struggling at school, or you know, is finding it really difficult to find friends, or to settle into their friends group. And again, to pick on something you said, during the whole COVID period, that's really set like a lot of kids backwards. And again, getting those children through that period of, you know, where they didn't have friends, where they weren't having that social contact, you know, that was really traumatic for everyone. But I would expect, and I would imagine, that a lot of that burden again fell on mothers, because they're often the first person that, you know, that a child is going to go to and express mm-hmm. their issues. Emmy, it has been absolutely.
I was just going to say really quickly, we've had all those things that you talk about. I have that all the time. Yeah. All the time I'm like trying to find solutions to all those things that you just talked about. And, you know, it's exhausting. It's amazing having children, but, you know, trying to find the time to do that and be a female founder, I take my hat off to anyone who's doing it, because, you know, they're amazing.
I couldn't agree with you more. And look, Emmy, it has been absolutely incredible having you here with me today. And I'm sure there are 101 more things that we could talk about and we should talk about at some point. But for the time being, for our listeners, if they want to find you online, where's the best place for them to look for you? Are you on LinkedIn, obviously?
LinkedIn, yeah.
And Twitter
LinkedIn,
as well?
That's where I hang out. Twitter, well, we're just saying I need to I'm on Twitter, but I'm never on it, if you know what I mean. So I need to reinstigate that, see what's going on.
Excellent. Well, Emmy, it's been wonderful talking to you today. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It's been great. I really enjoyed it.